The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
As for a talk today, what I'd like to do is to place the context of the meditation practice we do, of mindfulness practice, in a wider field, wider context of as it appears in Buddhism, by talking about it, Buddhist practice as training. And traditionally, Buddhism is said to offer three trainings: trainings in ethics, training in meditation, and training in wisdom. And someone who is the traditional ancient from the time of the Buddha word for someone who is a disciple of the Buddha or practitioner or follower of the Buddha or something like that was a trainee, sika. And someone who had completed the training was called a non-trainer or without training anymore. Training is a very important idea. And the Buddha clearly, in various teachings, likened the training of in the Dharma, in the Buddhism, to the kind of training that someone would have in developing a craft or a skill or training oneself in certain capacities, or even of training horses. So the training of us, and why this is a little bit interesting is that, or very important, is that sometimes in our world here in the modern Western insight meditation movement, sometimes it would seem that the only thing that we really put most emphasis on is meditation itself. And there's a lot of people in our kind of scene who think that's really where it's all at, and feel like everything else, you know, everything else is kind of too religious, and they don't want anything to do with it. They just want the pure meditation itself. But that's not how it's traditionally been taught. Meditation itself is taught within the a context, a mutually supported context of a variety of trainings. There's a training itself. People have asked me, because I've been involved in Zen practice, to compare Vipassana and Zen, insight, meditation, and Zen. And one of the things I like to say, point out, is that Vipassana, the word for insight meditation, it means insight meditation. It's a particular kind of meditation practice. Whereas Zen is more than meditation. If you want to compare apples and apples, you would compare Zen meditation with insight meditation. But if you compare insight meditation with Zen, Zen is a whole training. And when Zen was brought to the West, it was usually was brought by Japanese Zen monastic teachers who brought with them, like Suzuki Roshi, much of the traditional monastic training within which a person sits Zazen, sits Zen meditation. Our scene, insight meditation scene, was not brought by Asian teachers coming to the West so much. It was very young Western Americans who went to India and Thailand, learned the practice there, and they brought it back with them. And when they brought it back, when they were there, they didn't necessarily get the full training that the traditional monks and priests would get, where the training is, you know, sometimes decades long. These Westerners went and got very powerful meditation training, and some of them practiced as monks for a while. But then they left a lot of that behind, and partly to come here in the West and offer the tremendous power of this practice, unencumbered by the wider trainings, the wider religious kind of approaches that existed in Asia. But what's happened here in the West in the last 30 years is that a lot of people who've been serious practitioners of this practice feel at some point, well, just meditation is not enough. You know, you have to bring it into your life in a fuller, bigger way. You want it to be integrated into your full personality, your full character. It's not something you do just, you know, in the morning, sitting meditation, and that's it. And so there's been interest in how to apply the practice, bring the practice into wider aspects of our lives. And so there's been a slow growing appreciation of training as part of what we're doing. The other thing about training is not the same thing as educating or learning. Some people feel that the way to learn Buddhism is to read books and just learn a lot about what Buddhism has to teach. And if you really understand what Buddhism is, then you understand the truth. But understanding doesn't go that far. And I wouldn't say it's important to learn and stuff, but that's not, traditionally, that's not where the heart or the essence of Buddhist training or the development in, as a Buddhist practitioner occurs. In fact, there are plenty of teachers in Asia who, when they begin training someone, they tell them, don't read. And so, for example, when people come to the monastery to be monks or novices and nuns, studying is usually not very important, not emphasized very much. What's emphasized more is how you sweep the temple paths. What's emphasized more is learning the chants. What's emphasized more is sweeping, cleaning, decorum, how you carry yourself in the monastery, how you engage in the world, your speech, that you're careful with what you say, you wouldn't swear a lot or at all. And there's a whole kind of way of learning how to behave in the monastery, which is part of the training. And this is actually considered more important because that actually begins to change your behavior, your character, your, in a sense, almost your personality at times. And so what we're focusing on when we're training, we're focusing on developing capabilities we have, whereas your learning tends to be, the narrower definition of learning, you're learning ideas and concepts. And so so what are the different kinds of trainings that have traditionally been important in Buddhism? I mentioned already ethics, meditation, and wisdom. There's also, I would say it a little differently, in our scene, our Western scene, as we're kind of developing, I would say that we've kind of developed into have four trainings which are important. And these trainings are the training in mindfulness, the training in ethics, the training in generosity, and the training in loving kindness. So those are kind of like, I feel like, the four pillars of our kind of scene in the insight meditation in the West. Some people would say there's a few other things, or maybe add some more, but I think for me those are the four most common elements. And it isn't that you need to, you know, you're supposed to learn, read a book about loving kindness and read another book about loving kindness and read another book about loving kindness, and you know, that's not how you master it. Or it isn't that you just read a lot of books about generosity, you know. If you just read about generosity enough, you know, then certainly everything will be taken care of. And then you don't have to be generous, right? But generosity and loving kindness and ethics are not done in the abstract, but have to do with how we behave and what we do. And that isn't just only what we do, but it also has to do with the disposition we have, the way that our inner life has been formed or shaped, that is important as well, maybe more important how that's shaped. So not only are you generous, but you become a generous person. Not only do you practice loving kindness, but you become a loving person. Not only do you become, you practice integrity or ethics, but you become someone who's virtuous. That becomes kind of the nature of who you are. And these kinds of cultivations and developments is not something you just turn on from one moment to the next. Say, this is a good idea, I should do it. But it's a capacity and capability we have that grows in the repetitive practice of it. So part of training is repetition and doing it over and over and over again. So even for meditation itself, for whatever benefits you get from the kind of the essence of meditation, the experience of meditation itself is a training. And if you do it in a regular daily way as a training, it is a discipline, there's a variety of things which are being developed and cultivated in you. One is sense of discipline. One is maybe patience. One is resolve. Another is letting go of preferences. Some people will meditate only when they feel good, and some people will only meditate when they don't feel good, or they only meditate when they feel like it. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. But there's another opportunity, and the opportunity is to have it at meditation every day as a discipline that you do no matter what, short of the house burning down. But, you know, whether you like it or not, whether you're tired or not, whether you feel well or not, whether you're convinced that this is going to be a good meditation or not, I mean, you can sit down sometimes and feel like this is going to be just lousy. I'm going to be miserable. I have a headache, and I feel, you know, not good, and I'm tired, and why should I meditate? You know, it's just a waste of time. But if it's a discipline and training, you would do it anyway. And then you don't necessarily have a good meditation, but you learn to let go of your preferences. It's a training to learn to be patient, a training to learn to apply oneself even when one doesn't want to. So there's a variety of things that get cultivated and developed in that kind of environment. And if we just act on our preferences, a lot of things get undeveloped and untrained. So, in classic Buddhist training, one would work closely in community with other people and do that training together with others. You would get up in the morning and meditate with people, you'd chant with people, you'd work with people, you'd be interacting with people. And part of the training in the monastery is also to get along with people. And this is a very important part of the training. And people tend to go to monasteries. From a distance, people have this very idealized view of what Buddhist monasteries are like. I mean, everyone there is floating on a cloud. They're blissed out. They're just these beautiful, loving people. They're all like the Dalai Lama. And wouldn't it be nice to go there? And there are certainly some wonderful people, well-trained, developed people in monasteries. But it's good to think of Buddhist monasteries as being places that the people who go there really need to be there. And so the people who are challenged in some way in their life, they're suffering a lot. And so you tend to get a big, wide collection of people in the same place who often wouldn't ever choose to be together in other ways. And so people are bumping up against each other, and so there's a training in how to get along. And one of the common expressions in Buddhist monasteries is that it's kind of like, rocks in a river that are rolling around, tumbling, and bumping up against each other, and the rough edges get worn off. And so there's a training where people's rough edges, the way they get irritated or angry, or the way they're short, or the way that they are lazy or greedy or judgmental of others, a whole bunch of things that happen that you have to look at and see when you're in community, and the dedication is to be live somehow in harmony. And so this fits into the category of the ethics part. And it's a training to do that. And it's not necessarily easy to do. Part of the training in Buddhism, big part, is not only cultivating certain capacities we have to a strong degree, but it's also a process of purification, is the traditional language, or emptying out or letting go. So the letting go of our attachments, becoming free of our attachments, becoming free of the way we cling, becoming free of the way we're contracted and tight. And so, it's not often easy to let go of attachments we have. Some things might be easy, but some things are extremely hard, and sometimes we need a lot of help. And so the training in Buddhism offers training to help people learn to let go, support people in doing that. Sometimes through being very loving and supporting and nurturing of them, and sometimes, in a traditional way, the opposite of that, being sometimes very strict. And sometimes it's said if you really want to find a good place to train, go find a really strict teacher. And there's a story, which I think is a little bit unfortunate, but it kind of talks to this. One of the most famous Zen teachers in Japan said at some point when he got older, he said, you know, I'm going to retire as a teacher now because as I'm getting older, I'm becoming too kind to become an effective teacher. You need some strictness in order to train people and keep people applying themselves. Suzuki Roshi, who started the San Francisco Zen Center, His teacher was extremely strict, and he said that there were six other monks training with him when he was training there, and they all ran away. It was so strict. But he stayed, and he said it was really beneficial for me, because in this kind of training, you really have to look at yourself. You're challenged, and you have to let go a lot. So I've done both Zen training, and I've done a lot of Vipassana, and I'm a teacher in this insight meditation movement. And I'm a teacher in it because I think it's extremely valuable. I value it a lot, and I love it, and I like sharing it with people. Even so, it has some weaknesses. And one of the weaknesses is that it doesn't really offer the full training that Zen training would. So if you go spend time at San Francisco Zen Center, living there for a while, much more of you gets churned and cultivated and challenged than if you go on a Vipassana retreat or you come to IMC. You're like kind of left alone. So for example, the schedule for our retreats that we teach are suggestions, which means you don't have to go sit. It says come sit, a certain time, and you say, that's a good idea. Or say, no, I think, I'll go for a walk in the hills. And people do that. I'm tired, I don't feel like it, I need a break, and people monitor themselves. There's a wisdom to that. But there's also what happens is people sometimes don't push themselves. They don't, they're not strict with themselves. They give in too easily. They don't push themselves over the hurdles or go through the difficult times so easily. They just go for a hike instead. Once when I was teaching at Spirit Rock, this man came in for his interview in the middle of the retreat. And he said, he looked really happy and he was present. And he said, I just came from the golf course down the street. I got in my car and went down there and did a round of golf and came back. I never heard that before. I guess it's a different kind of training. But in the Zen training, the schedule is not a suggestion. It's a requirement. And whether you want to or not, you have to show up for the scheduled meditation. And so, and there's a whole series of things like that. You don't like to have religion because they have all this chanting and bowing. You're kind of like you don't believe in religiosity and you don't want to have any of that. Tough. If in Zen training, you've got to go along and do it and deal with your resistance to it. And perhaps you have good reason to be anti-religious, but the resistance to it and holding back and being self-righteous about it is just suffering for yourself. And so perhaps the training would be to learn to let go of your resistance to it and your adding meaning to it and just do the bowing and do the chanting without any, just taking, without taking it on or believing it, but just, giving up your resistance and being free in the middle of it. So what I've seen in these two different communities is people get trained in different things. And in our community, a lot of people get trained very much to look into their inner life, their psychology, their inner life. And sometimes people can go quite deep into themselves when they do Vipassana practice. What I've seen in Zen is that people tend to get trained more broadly in their life much better. And they get much better trained to live in community. They get much better trained in learning to let go and not be slaves to their preferences, their ideas of comfort, but they're willing to let go, be uncomfortable, and be let go, and just be comfortable with the letting go, comfortable with the discomfort. I remember once someone came to Spirit Rock for a retreat. Spirit Rock's a very nice retreat center, in terms of retreat centers in the world. Buddhist world, especially the ancient world, the old back in Asia. I mean, it is like, primo. And so I think the window in the dorm wasn't working very well. So I think what happened was the room got a little bit too hot because the window couldn't open or something. And the practitioner came to the wrote angry letter and said, if this was the Hilton, I'd get a refund. and if traditional training is you go to a monastery to practice, you take the accommodations that are given, no questions, no protest, whatever is given. And if you're new in the monastery, you're usually given the worst place. And then maybe as you get seniority, you move up to better places. But you don't complain. That's part of the training. You just take what's given. And I ended up sleeping sometimes on wooden planks in the monasteries in Asia, in point of kind of public spaces, just on wood, because that's what was available. And, you know, that's part of the training, is to learn to go along with that and not be attached to creature comforts that we might have. So there's a tendency at Spirit Rock for people to kind of err on the side of being self-indulgent and wanting to be comfortable and not learning the value of the training in letting go. In the Zen, there's much more of that training of learning to let go and just accept what's given, accept the circumstances. I think it's a powerful training, but sometimes people err too much on that side, and they think that what it's all about is kind of self-effacement, all about this being strict and being stoic and kind of toughing everything out, and that's not valuable. That can be overdone as well. At Spirit Rock, one of the things that they're trying to cultivate now is the sense that when you come there, part of the training is to accept the room you're given, and partly because some of the rooms are doubles, and so you probably could believe how much soap opera there is about people getting signals or double, and I think everyone at Spirit Rock who built Spirit Rock realized they made a huge mistake in having any double rooms at all, because of how much, you know, this person snores, this person needs the window open, this window closed, and so there's all this goes on. Whereas you go to a Zen monastery in Japan, you just accept, you know, you don't ask about the window open or closed. When I was in a monastery in Japan, I slept in a room with something like 26 other guys. You know, just we're all together on tatami mats, these hard mats. And, your preferences don't really count. So it's a training. Another part of the training that's very traditional in Buddhism, in Zen, but a lot of this also exists in Theravadan Buddhism, where our practice comes from, just we kind of left it behind. And if you want to see that kind of training in full force, you'd go to some of the monasteries. Abhayagiri, for example, up in northern Nyukaya. Another form of the training is having a close relationship to a teacher, and having a certain commitment to a teacher and certain accountability to a teacher, and maybe having a teacher strict or who calls you on things, being an attendant to a teacher, attending to a teacher, paying attention to the teacher. What are the teacher's needs? Does the teacher need a glass of water? Does the teacher need whatever? And you're paying attention. It's a training in attention. It's a training in understanding and tuning into someone else. And it's also being in relationship to someone who's practiced more than you, in order to get feedback. And there's all kinds of feedback you might get. And you might get all kinds of requests from a teacher who knows you. They might, if you entered into a relationship with a teacher where there's permission to do this, part of what the teacher, when the teacher asks you to do something, to help with a teacher, help in the monastery, help with something, it's understood to be part of your training. If you're an assistant to the teacher, part of the advantages of that is you get to see the teacher in close quarters. And you get to see the kind of decisions the teacher makes, how the teacher behaves. Someone told me today that the story, a Jewish story, of someone who went a long distance to spend time with a rabbi, in order to watch him tie his shoes. So the idea is how you conduct your life is as much a teaching as what you might teach when you're sitting up giving a Dharma talk. And so part of the training is to live together in close circumstances with the teachers or more senior practitioners, because all kinds of things rub off. Both the good rubs off from the teacher to you, but then the bad rubs off from you when you're up against someone. So Buddhism traditionally has been about cultivation or training. The training involves both the cultivation of qualities, capacities we have, you know, ethics, loving kindness, generosity, mindfulness, other things like wisdom, patience, equanimity, tranquility, resolve, joy, happiness. There's a lot of things we can cultivate, and the cultivation comes from regular ongoing practice, the repetition of it over and over again. The repetition of the same discipline regularly, engaging in a committed discipline, has also the advantage that it begins to challenge us around our attachments, challenge us about how we keep our life in a limited way, and supports us to try to let go in deeper and deeper ways. And I've known people who have matured in Buddhism a tremendous amount, not because of their meditation practice, but because of all the other trainings that they were involved in. Because of how they kind of have purified and worked on them and their attachments. And that was kind of like, that was the cauldron in which they were kind of being cooked, being developed. So the question then is, you know, it's one thing, it's easier to get that than monasteries, where you're living together and all that. How do people who are not going to be in monasteries, lay practitioners who don't have, you know, have full lives, how can they do something comparable? How can they train? I think we're always being trained. Or it has to do with taking what you, the demands and the needs and situation of your life and approaching it as a training. Someone said today that, it was quoting someone else who said something like, hell is not a punishment. It's a place for training. And I thought that was a great perspective, that you change your perspective on the difficulties of your life. And if you say, oh, this is a place for training. It's not like just disaster has befallen me. Or the cooks at Spirit Rock, the retreat center, say, they used to have a sign, I don't think it's there anymore, outside the kitchen in the dining room. It said, our practice is to make the best food we can. When we don't, then it's your practice. So don't come and complain. Practice with it, you know. Just, you know, learn to accept what's given, even if it doesn't taste tasty or it's burnt, you know. And it doesn't have to be this hot cuisine at Spirit Rock, you know. It's already phenomenal food. It's really a food cult up there. But when it's not good food, then the trainings, you accept what's given, which is an ancient training in Buddhism for monastics. They go out in the bowl, and they whatever people put in the bowl in the morning, that's what they eat. And everything gets mixed up together. You know, desserts and salads and soups and, you know, just in the bowl, and they just scoop it out afterwards. Not to have preferences, to be free of that. So the question is, I don't know how well I've conveyed this, the role and the place of training in Buddhism, but the question is this interesting for you? And then, since you're probably not going to go off to the monastery anytime soon, how could you do this in your daily life? One person I was talking to today about this said, well, I got plenty of that training. I'm a mother. And I think it's true. I think that there are certain roles that we have in our society, lay roles, which require a lot of us, that require a lot and has a lot of the same benefits and effects that monastic training has. But I think it's augmented if we understand it as training. If we go into a work every day and demanding situation at work, and rather than saying this is terrible and going kicking and fighting or trying to slip away or whatever, but embrace it fully, this is a place of training. I will now see my difficult boss as the strict abbot who's doing everything he or she can to help me let go or to help develop my patience or help develop my equanimity or to help develop me. So can you bring a perspective to the challenges you have in your life so it's not punishment, but rather it's a place of training? I think if we begin kind of having a sense of that, then we can get a lot of the same benefits that monastics can get, or monastic training can provide when people stay out, you know, can go and do it in those environments. So that was my attempt to try to kind of point out the traditional way in which Buddhism occurs, that maybe is not so well appreciated, understood here in the modern West and the insight meditation movement. So we have a few minutes now. I would like to hear some questions or concerns or comments about this. Yes. So if you can use the mic, please.
Thank you. My question is about passivity. Doesn't it cultivate to be passive against the adversary, or
how do you cultivate passivity?
No. What you are saying, let go. When you let go, you are submitting to the situation. And then it appears to be passive.
It appears to be passive.
So
it doesn't have to be passive. Passive. Well, there is a kind of letting go, yes. So, for example, you're my good disciple, right? Let's say pretend, right? And I'm the teacher. Can you give me some more water? So let's go get some water and come back.
Okay.
I'm really thirsty. There's a lot of people waiting here for something to happen.
I filled it half.
So, now, you could say that was pretty passive. You were just my puppet. Right, and just kind of go along, and it's this cult thing here, and I just, sent my disciples out to do something, right? That's one way to see it. But it also required, but let's look at it from a different perspective. Rather than being passive and accepting just going along, what kind of training, what kind of useful training would having that kind of relationship and that kind of instructions? It certainly required you to be active. I mean, you were hustling.
So I see it this way. I don't know if you would assert on that. I am not able to change the world.
Yes.
But the way I change myself, it's going to take me to a newer state of being, which relates me in a different way to the world,
yes.
Which is the change that I did not have before.
Yes, that's the point. That's the hope.
So I'm seeing it that way, and that's why I was.
But you're worried that the change makes you too much of a passive person.
No, letting go or at that point, accepting whatever is coming toward me, I was seeing it as passive.
I see. So I was. It could be. And that's one of the dangers in any kind of training, that a person is too passive and too accepting and accepts things that shouldn't be accepted, for sure. But there's also something very, I think, so in this training I gave you, I hope you don't mind too much that I did it, you had to let go of all kinds of things, and perhaps. You had to let go of sitting here getting an answer. You had to let go of, your... any kind of concern what other people are going to think about you, because there's all these people watching how good you are at getting water, and are you a good water getter? and then I didn't even say thank you, right? I just so you have to deal with you're expecting the teacher was going to say thank you and what a great water getter you are, and I hardly acknowledged you, right? And so you have to let go of a lot of stuff, just in order to stay here, and so it might not So later in your life, you've learned, in some challenging situation, you've learned how not to assert yourself or hold on to some narrow sense of self. You've learned when your baby is crying that you get out of bed and deal with it immediately. And it's a lot easier because you've learned to do it in the monastery. And so I don't know if we're talking about the same thing here, but there is a, okay. Okay. So, someone else? Straight back.
So, thank you so much for drawing the distinction, and I can really understand that. But my question is actually maybe too narrow, and that is that when we've had Zen people with Zen training here, their talks are very different from people who have more of a Vipassana tradition. And their talks tend to be very abstract, and they don't touch my heart. It's more just kind of very abstract thoughts. And I was wondering if you could speak to that. It's difficult for me to absorb what they're. It's more difficult for me to absorb what they're saying.
Well, some of that might be particular subcultures of Zen, rather than Zen as a whole. And some subcultures of Zen are a little bit more intellectual, and working with paradox or working with a little bit kind of mysterious stuff that you're trying to understand. Now, one of the differences that I've seen in the Zen world and the Vipassana world between Dharma talks is that there's a tendency, not all insight meditation teachers, but there's a much stronger tendency of insight meditation teachers to give a lot of information, and sometimes with great clarity, but they're more like giving you lots of information, techniques, practices, perspective, and just a lot of information. In Zen, and they have notes, and they're reading the notes that's prepared ahead of time, and in Zen, you're not supposed to really use notes traditionally. And in Zen, the most important part of the Dharma talk is not what's being said, but how a person is when they're giving the talk. And so there's a manifestation quality where you're supposed to manifest or transmit your freedom or your understanding more than what happens through words. So sometimes in Zen talks, you're not actually supposed to listen to the words so much, but rather get a feel and sense of the person who's there and how they are and how they're showing up. And you'll sit, you can get, you can, and you can, some insight meditation teachers, like John Travis, have you ever heard him? I mean, his words are secondary to this tremendous transmission of heart that comes through him. And how he is really the beautiful thing of his talks. I think that really moves people. And some people have the same relationship to his talks as some people do to these Zen teachers, as you have. But it's transmission that's important. So you might try next time a Zen teacher comes is to take it in a different way than how you would take in an insight talk, where the ideas are much more important or what's being Does that make some sense? And there's a lot to be said about this topic, but that's all I want to say now. One more. No? Yes, please. It's okay. Right here.
Well, I mean, at the risk of bringing this up again, I wanted to say one thing about the passivity. I had a thought about it, and I wonder what you think about it. Is it that you're kind of choosing to submit to the things that are being offered to you to do, and so because you're making a choice about it, it's not really truly passive?
Yeah, that's perfectly true. I mean, if you really understand, you're supposed to go into this willingly and understand the value of what you're trying to do. Or have some faith that the teacher knows what's good for you. And so it's not really meant to be a passive thing. It's supposed to be very active. And in fact, traditional training, it's a very active training. It's very active. You know, learning to let go and learn to cultivate yourself and engage in the whole monastic thing, it's far from a passive engagement, even though you might be sitting still at times. So there's an active choice. And then I think how much value you get from the letting go, when the letting go is part of it, has a lot to do with how well you understand yourself and how deep you're willing to probe into yourself to understand where it is you're holding on. So, for example, to be asked to do something in the monastery by the teacher, Oh, so this is a great example of letting go that happens in the Zen monasteries. I had this experience. You're a Zen, young, idealistic Zen student. You're sitting, you're getting concentrated. Meditation's where it's at. You're on the brink of enlightenment. You feel, you're really important. You know, that you're sitting there meditating in the hall with everyone, and it's going to happen any moment, you're sure. And then someone comes and taps you on the shoulder and says, you're needed in the kitchen to work in the kitchen right now. You know, you can't just turn around and say, wait a minute. I have my spiritual practice, you know, what I'm doing, what's really important, you know, is meditation is the most important thing at all, and my practice is so important, I'm the one who's going to get enlightened, and, you know, that doesn't cut it in the monastery. You're asked to go, you got to get up and go to the kitchen and work, or you pack up and leave. Those are your choices. And so you could say it's passage to accept what's being told, and sometimes people are too passive, and there's dangers in being that kind of passively accepting, for sure. But it's a powerful training in attachments, in conceit, in being... People get really attached to spiritual practice, and that's their big hang-up. And so, and attached to their spiritual experiences, boy, I'm really concentrated now, I feel really good. The kitchen? And then the ideas, we have ideas about what is real practice and what is not real practice. I did, you know, like meditation is really where the practice is at. Peeling potatoes in the kitchen, that's not practice. you got to go to the kitchen. And so you can go to the kitchen and be just passively let go of what goes on in the Zendo. Or you could actively look and see, what was I doing there? Why was it so hard? Why did I get so angry and upset when they asked me? What was going on with me? What was I attached to? What were my values? What was my understanding? And then when you go to the kitchen, you don't just passively kind of, you know, do the potato peeling, but you say, okay, now how can I peel the potato? So this is now a training. How can I get myself completely over and be fully engaged and mindful and concentrated on peeling potatoes? The samadhi of potato peeling. And so that would be the task. So rather than seeing potato peeling as as punishment or something, you know, a deviation from practice, your responsibility is to actively find, how can I make this into practice? How can I take this on now? And without the practice student being actively pursuing and looking and looking for the training, looking how to get the best out of different circumstances that are difficult, there's no real training. So you can't be passive. There has to be an engagement in what you're doing. Okay? Well, I hope it was okay to get this kind of different kind of flavor. There's much more we could say and talk about. It's a big topic. And if some of you didn't like what you hear today, then consider yourself lucky. Because if a teacher only says things that you like, it's probably not a teacher you should hang out with. So thank you.